the pressure of her hand. It was right on top of the tape deck. He tried a little turn this way and a little turn that way, but she still had her hand on it. He tried a real shimmy. No use. Now she had a grip on it.
"Shaman, what is this?"
"I don't know. My belt? My belt buckle? I don't know."
"You don't have a belt buckle in the back."
Now she pulled loose from him in front, but she still had her hand on the deck. "Maria? What the hell?" He swung to the side in an arc, but she swung around behind him like a college wrestler looking for a takedown. He got a glimpse of her face, half a smile, half a furious scowl, an ugly dawn breaking. He spun and broke free. She confronted him head on.
"Shaman!"
A quizzical smile, waiting for the right instant to break into a howl of accusation. Slowly.
"I want to know, what's that on your back?"
"For God's sake, Maria, what's gotten into you? It's nothing. My suspender buttons, maybe. I don't know."
"I want to see, Shaman."
"What do you mean, see?"
"Take off your jacket."
"What do you mean?"
"Take it off. I want to see."
"That's crazy.
You've taken off a lot more than that in here, Shaman."
"Come on, Maria. You're being silly."
"Then humor me. Let me see what's on your back."
A plea. "Maria, come on. It's too late in the day to play games." She came toward him, the terrible smile still on her face. She was going to see for herself. He jumped to one side. She came after him. He dodged again. A would-be game-like giggle. "What are you doing, Maria?" Beginning to breathe heavily.
"We'll see."
She charged at him. He couldn't get out of the way. Her hands were on his chest, trying to get at his shirt. He covered himself like a maiden. "Maria!" The howl began.
"You're hiding something, aren't you?"
"Now just hold on."
"You're hiding something. What do you got under your shirt?"
She lunged at him again. He dodged, but before he knew it, she was behind him. She had her hands under his jacket. She had a grip on the tape deck, although it was still under his shirt, and his shirt was still tucked into his pants. He could feel it coming away from his back.
"And a wire, Shaman?"
He clamped down on her hand with his own to keep her from pulling it out, but her hand was under his jacket, and his hand was on top of the jacket. He began hopping around, holding onto this writhing, red, angry mass under his jacket.
"It's own, wire, you bastard!"
The words were squirting out in awful grunts as the two of them hopped about. Only the exertion kept her from screaming bloody murder. Now he had her hand by the wrist. He had to make her let go. He squeezed harder and harder.
"You're hurting me!"
He squeezed harder. She gave a little shriek and let go. For a moment, he was paralyzed by the fury in her face.
"Shaman, you rotten, dishonest bastard!"
"Maria, I swear..."
"You swear, do you?"
She lunged again. He bolted for the door. She grabbed one sleeve and the back of his jacket. He tried to wrench free. The sleeve began tearing away from the body. He plowed on toward the door. He could feel the tape deck bouncing on his buttocks. It was hanging out of his pants by now, out from under the shirt and hanging off his body by the wire. Then there was a blur of black silk and a thud. Maria was on the floor. One of her high heels had buckled and her legs went out from under her. Sherman ran to the door. It was all he could do to open it because his jacket was pulled down over his arms. Now he was out into the hallway. He heard Maria sobbing, and then she yelled out,
"That's right! Run! Drag your tail between your legs!"
It was true. He was hobbling down the stairs with the tape deck dangling ignominiously down his backside. He felt more shameful than any dog. By the time he reached the front door, the truth had hit him. Through stupidity, incompetence, and funk, he had now managed to lose his one last hope. Oh, Master of the Universe. Chapter 30. An Able Pupil. The grand jury rooms in the island fortress were not like regular courtrooms. They were like small amphitheaters. The members of the grand jury looked down on the table and chair where the witnesses sat. Off to one side was the clerk's table. There was no judge in a grand jury proceeding. The prosecutor sat his witnesses down in the chair and questioned them, and the grand jury decided either that the case was strong enough to put the defendant on trial, or that it wasn't, and threw the case out. The concept, which had originated in England in 1681, was that the grand jury would protect the citizenry against unscrupulous prosecutors. That was the concept, and the concept had become a joke. If a defendant wanted to testify before the grand jury, he could bring his lawyer into the grand jury room. If he was A, perplexed, or B, petrified, or C, grievously abused by the prosecutor's questions, he could leave the room and confer with a lawyer outside in the hall, and thereby look like someone who was B, petrified, a defendant with something to hide. Not many defendants took the chance. Grand jury hearings had become a show run by the prosecutor. With rare exceptions, a grand jury did whatever a prosecutor indicated he wanted them to do. 99% of the time, he wanted them to indict the defendant, and they obliged without a blink. They were generally law and order folk anyway. They were chosen from long-time residents of the community. Every now and then, when political considerations demanded it, a prosecutor wanted to have a charge thrown out. No problem. He merely had to couch his presentation in a certain way, give a few verbal winks, as it were, and the grand jury would catch on immediately. But mainly, you use the grand jury to indict people, and in the famous phrase of Saul Wachtler, chief judge of the State Court of Appeals, a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich, if that's what you wanted. You presided over the proceedings. You presented the evidence, questioned the witnesses, gave the summations. You stood up while the witnesses sat. You orated, gestured, walked about, spun on your heels, shook your head in disbelief, or smiled in paternal approbation, while the witnesses sat properly in their seats and looked up at you for direction. You were both the director and the star of this little amphitheater production. The stage was all yours. And Larry Kramer had rehearsed his actors well. The Roland Auburn, who came walking into the grand jury room this morning, neither looked nor walked like the hard case who had popped up in Kramer's office 2 weeks ago. He wore a button-down shirt, albeit with no necktie. It had been enough of a struggle to get him into the lame Brooks Brothers button-down shirt. He wore a blue-gray tweed sport jacket, of which his opinion was roughly the same, and a pair of black pants, which he already owned and weren't too bad. The whole ensemble had nearly come apart over the issue of the shoes. Roland had an obsession with Reebok sneakers, which had to be new right out of the box, snow white. At Rikers Island, he managed to get 2 new pairs per week. This showed the world that he was a hard case worthy of respect inside the walls, and a shrewd player with connections outside. To ask him to walk out of Rikers without his white Reeboks was like asking a singer to cut off his hair. So Kramer finally let him leave Rikers with the Reeboks on, with the understanding that he would change into a pair of leather shoes in the car before they arrived at the courthouse. The shoes were loafers, which Roland found contemptible. He demanded assurances that no one he knew or might know be allowed to see him in this lame condition. The final problem was the pimp roll. Roland was like a runner who's been running marathons too long, very hard to change the stride. Finally, Kramer had a brainstorm. He had Roland walk with his hands clasped behind his back, the way he had seen Prince Philip and Prince Charles walk on television while inspecting an artifacts museum in New Guinea. It worked. The clasped hands locked his shoulders, and the locked shoulders threw his hip rhythm off. So now, as Roland came walking into the grand jury room toward the table at center stage in his preppy clothes, he could have passed for a student at Lawrenceville, ruminating over the lake poets. Roland took his seat on the witness chair the way Kramer had told him to, that is, without rearing back and spreading his legs as if he owned the joint and without popping his knuckles. Kramer looked at Roland, and then turned and faced the grand jury, and took a few steps this way and a few steps that way, and gave them a thoughtful smile, in such a way as to announce, without saying a word, "This is a sympathetic and believable individual sitting before you." Kramer asked Roland to state his occupation, and Roland said softly, modestly, "I'm an artist." Kramer asked him if he was currently employed. "No, he was not," said Roland. Kramer nodded for a few moments, then began a line of questioning that brought out precisely why this young man of talent, this young man eager to find an outlet for his creativity, had not found the proper outlet, and was in fact currently facing a minor drug charge. The crack king of Evergreen Avenue had abdicated and become a mere serf of the environment. Like his friend Henry Lamb, but without Henry Lamb's advantages in terms of a stable home life, Roland had challenged the crushing odds against young men in the projects and emerged with his dreams intact. There was just this matter of keeping body and soul together, and Roland had drifted into a pernicious commerce, but one not at all uncommon in the ghetto. Neither he, the prosecutor, nor Roland, the witness, was attempting to hide or minimize his petty crimes, but given the environment in which he had lived, they should not impair his credibility among fair-minded people in a matter as grave as the fate of Henry Lamb. Charles Dickens, he who explained the career of Oliver Twist, couldn't have done it any better, at least not on his feet in a grand jury room in the Bronx. Then Kramer led Roland through the narrative of the hit-and-run accident. He lingered, lovingly, on one particular moment. It was the moment at which the foxy-looking brunette yelled at the tall man who'd been driving the car. "And what did she say to him, Mr. Auburn?"
"She say, 'Shulman, watch out.'"
"She said, 'Shulman?'"
"That's what it sound like to me."
"Would you say that name again, Mr. Auburn, exactly the way you heard it that night?"
"Shulman."
"Shulman, watch out?"
"That's right. Shulman, watch out."
"Thank you." Kramer turned toward the jurors and let "Shulman" float there in the air. The individual sitting in that witness chair was a young man of those mean streets whose bravest and best efforts had not been enough to save Henry Lamb from the criminal negligence and irresponsibility of a Park Avenue investment banker. Carl Brill, the gypsy cab operator, came into the room and told how Roland Auburn had indeed hired one of his cabs to rescue Henry Lamb. Edgar, Curly Kale, Tubb, told of driving Mr. Auburn and Mr. Lamb to the hospital. He could remember nothing of what Mr. Lamb said except that he was in pain. Officers William Martin and David Goldberg told of their dogged police work in tracing part of a license number to an investment banker on Park Avenue who became flustered and evasive. They told how Roland Auburn, without hesitation, identified Sherman McCoy from a lineup of photographs. A parking garage attendant named Daniel Perdernley told of how Sherman McCoy had taken his Mercedes-Benz Roadster out on the night in question, during the hours in question, and had returned in a state of dishevelment and agitation. They all came in and sat down at the table and looked up at the forceful but patient young assistant district attorney, whose every gesture, every pause, every stride said, "We have but to let them tell their story their own way, and the truth makes itself manifest." And then he brought her in. Maria Ruskin came into the amphitheater from an antechamber, where a court officer manned the door. She was superb. She had struck just the right note in her wardrobe, a black dress with a matching jacket edged in black velvet. She had not dressed up, and she had not dressed down. She was the perfect widow in mourning who had business to attend to. And yet her youth, her voluptuousness, her erotic presence, her sensual self seemed ready to burst forth from those clothes, from that stunning but composed face, from that full, flawless head of dark hair ready to be tousled with mad abandon at any moment, on any pretext, with the next tickle, the merest wink. Kramer could hear the jurors rustling and buzzing. They had read the newspapers. They had watched television. The foxy brunette, the mystery girl, the financier's widow. It was her. Involuntarily, Kramer pulled in his midsection and flattened his abdomen and threw back his shoulders and his head. He wanted her to see his powerful chest and neck, not his unlucky pate. Too bad he couldn't tell the jury the whole story. They would enjoy it. They would view him with renewed respect. The very fact that she had walked through that door and was now sitting at this table right on cue had been a triumph, his triumph, and not merely of his words, but of his particular presence. But of course he couldn't tell them about his visit to the Foxy Brunette's apartment, to her containerized palace. Had she decided to support McCoy in the story he had concocted about a robbery on a ramp, it would have been very much a problem. The whole case would have been thrown back on the credibility of Roland Auburn, the erstwhile crack king, who was now trying to leverage himself out of a jail term. Roland's testimony provided the foundation for a case, but not a very solid one, and Roland was capable of blowing it at any moment, not by what he said, Kramer had no doubt that he was telling the truth, but through his demeanor. But now he had her, too. He had gone to her apartment and looked her in the eye, her and her wasp retainers, too, and he had put her in a box of irrefutable logic and dread of the power. He had put her in that box so quickly and securely she hadn't even known what was happening. She had swallowed, gulped her multi-million-dollar gulp, and it was all over. By nightfall, Messrs. Tucker, Trigg, and Clifford Pretty, Trigg and Pretty, Pretty and Trigg, oh ye wasps, had been on the telephone to make the deal. Now she was seated before him. And he looked down at her and let his eyes fasten upon hers. Seriously at first, and then with, or so he imagined it, a twinkle. "Would you please state your full name and address?"
"Maria Teresa Ruskin, 962 Fifth Avenue."
"Very good, Maria Teresa." It was he himself, Kramer, who had discovered her middle name was Teresa. He had figured there would be a few older Italian and Puerto Rican women on the grand jury, and sure enough there were. Maria Teresa would bring her closer to them. A touchy matter, her beauty and her money. The jurors were staring ropes. They couldn't get enough of her. She was the most glamorous human being they had ever seen in the flesh. How long had it been since anybody had sat in a witness chair in this room and given an address on Fifth Avenue in the 70s? She was everything they were not, and, Kramer was sure, wanted to be, young, gorgeous, chic, and unfaithful. And yet that could be a positive advantage, so long as she behaved in a certain fashion, so long as she was humble and modest and seemed slightly abashed by the scale of her own advantages, so long as she was little Maria Teresa from a small town in South Carolina, so long as she took pains to be one of us at heart, they would feel flattered by their association with her in this excursion into criminal justice, by her success and celebrity, by the very aura of her money. He asked her to state her occupation. She hesitated and stared at him with her lips parted slightly, then said,
I'm a housewife.
A rush of laughter ran through the jurors, and Maria cast her eyes down and smiled modestly and shook her head slightly as if to say, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I don't know what else to say. Kramer could tell by the way the jurors smiled in return that so far they were on her side. They were already captivated by this rare and beautiful bird who now fluttered before them in the Bronx. Kramer took this moment to say, I think the jurors should be made aware that Mrs. Ruskin's husband, Mr. Arthur Ruskin, passed away just 5 days ago. Under these circumstances, we are indebted to her for her willingness to come forward at this time and cooperate with this jury in these deliberations. The jurors stared at Maria all over again. Brave, brave girl. Maria lowered her eyes again, quite becomingly. Good girl, Maria. Maria Teresa, housewife. If only he could give these worthy jurors a little exegesis of how he had coached her in these small but telling points. All true and honest, but even truth and honesty can disappear without a light. So far she had been a bit cool toward him, but she followed directions and thereby signaled her respect. Well, there would be many sessions to come when they went to trial. And even at this moment, in this room, under these austere circumstances, at this plain dock of justice, there was something about her ready to burst forth. A crook of the finger, a single wink. Calmly, quietly, to show how difficult he knew this must be for her, he began to lead her through the events of the fateful evening. Mr. McCoy had picked her up at Kennedy Airport. No need for the purposes of these proceedings to say why. They got lost in the Bronx. They're a bit anxious. Mr. McCoy is driving in the left lane of a wide avenue. She sees a sign over on the right indicating a way back to an expressway. He suddenly veers right at a high speed. He's heading straight for two boys standing on the edge of the pavement. He sees them too late. He grazes one, nearly hits the other. She tells him to stop. He does. Now, Mrs. Ruskin, would you please tell us... At this point, when Mr. McCoy stopped, was the car on the ramp to the expressway or on the avenue itself?
It was on the avenue.
The avenue?
Yes.
And was there any obstruction or barricade or any kind of obstacle that caused Mr. McCoy to stop the car where he did?
No.
All right. Tell us what happened then. Mr. McCoy got out to see what had happened, and she opened the door and looked back. They could see both youths heading toward the car. And would you please tell us your reaction when you observed them coming toward you?
I was frightened. I thought they were going to attack us because of what had happened.
Because Mr. McCoy had hit one of them?
Yes.
Eyes downcast, perhaps in shame. Did they threaten you verbally or through any sort of gesture?
No, they did not.
More shame. But you thought they might attack you?
Yes.
A humble tone. A kindly voice. Could you explain why?
Because we were in the Bronx, and it was at night.
A gentle, paternal voice. Is it also possible that it was because these two young men were black? A pause.
Yes.
Do you think Mr. McCoy felt the same way?
Yes.
Did he at any time verbally indicate that he felt that way?
Yes, he did.
What did he say?
I don't remember exactly, but we talked about it later, and he said it was like being in a fight in the jungle.
A fight in the jungle? These two young men walking toward you after one of them has been struck by Mr. McCoy's car, this was like a fight in the jungle?
That was what he said, yes.
Kramer paused to let that sink in. All right. The two young men are approaching Mr. McCoy's car. What did you do then?
What did I do?
What did you do or say?
I said, Sherman, watch out.
Sherman. One of the jurors giggled. Kramer said, Would you repeat that, please, Mrs. Ruskin? Repeat what you said to Mr. McCoy.
I said, Sherman, watch out.
Now, Mrs. Ruskin, if you'll permit me, you have a distinctive accent. You give Mr. McCoy's first name a soft pronunciation. Sherman, isn't that correct? A regretful but becoming little smile crossed her face.
I guess so. You're a better judge than I am.
Well, would you pronounce it in your own way for us just once more, Mr. McCoy's first name?
Sherman.
Kramer turned toward the jurors and just looked at them. Sherman. All right, Mrs. Ruskin. What happened next? She told how she slid behind the wheel and Mr. McCoy got in the passenger seat and she sped off, very nearly hitting the young man who had escaped injury when Mr. McCoy was driving. Once they were safely back on the expressway, she had wanted to report the incident to the police, but Mr. McCoy would have none of it. Why was he reluctant to report what had happened?
He said he was driving when it happened, and so it was his decision to make, and he wasn't going to report it.
Yes, but he must have offered a reason.
He said it was just an incident in the jungle, and it wouldn't do any good to report it anyway, and he didn't want word to get back to his employer and his wife. I think he was more worried about his wife.
Knowing that he had hit someone with his car?
Knowing that he had picked me up at the airport.
Eyes downcast. And that was reason enough not to report that a young man had been struck, and as it turns out, gravely injured?
Well, I don't know. I don't know everything that was on his mind.
Softly, sadly. Very good, Maria Teresa, an able pupil, most becoming to confess the limits of your knowledge. And thus the lovely Widow Ruskin sank Mr. Sherman McCoy like a stone. Kramer left the grand jury room in the state of bliss known chiefly to athletes who have just won a great victory. He tried hard to suppress a smile. "Hey, Larry." Bernie Fitzgibbon was hurrying toward him down the hall. Good. Now he had a war story and a half for the Black Irishman. But before he could get out the first word about his triumph, Bernie said, "Larry, have you seen this?" He thrust a copy of the City Light toward him. Quigley, who had just come in, picked up the City Light from Killian's desk and read it for himself. Sherman sat beside the desk in the miserable fiberglass armchair and averted his eyes, but he could still see it, the front page. A band across the top read, "Exclusive, New McCoy Case Shocker." On the upper left-hand side of the page was a picture of Maria in a low-cut dress with the tops of her breasts welling up and her lips parted. The picture was set into a headline of enormous black type that read, "Come into my rent-controlled love nest." Below, a band of smaller type, "Millionaires Maria entertained McCoy in a $331-a-month tryst pad," by Peter Fallow. Killian was behind the desk, leaning back in his swivel chair and studying Sherman's gloomy face. "Look," said Killian, "don't worry about it. It's a sleazy story, but it don't hurt our case any. Maybe it helps. It tends to undermine her credibility. She comes off looking like a hooker."
"That's very true," said Quigley, in a voice that was supposed to be encouraging. "We already know where she was when her husband was dying. She was in Italy, shacked up with some kid named Filippo.
And now here's this guy Winter saying she had guys up there all the time. This Winter's a prince, ain't he, Tommy?"
"A real lovable landlord," said Killian, then to Sherman. "If Maria rats you out, then this can only help. Not a lot, but some."
"I'm not thinking about the case," said Sherman. He sighed and let his great chin sink down to his collarbone. "I'm thinking about my wife. This will do it. I think she'd halfway forgiven me, or at least she was going to be with me, she was going to keep our family together. But this will do it."
"You got involved with a high-class hooker," said Killian. "It happens all the time. It's not that big a deal."
"Hooker?" To his own surprise, Sherman felt an urge to defend Maria. But what he said was, "Unfortunately, I swore to my wife that I'd never done anything but flirt with her once or twice."
"You really think she believed that?" said Killian.
"It doesn't matter," said Sherman.
"I swore that was the truth, and then I asked her to forgive me. I made a big point of it, and now she learns with the rest of New York, with the rest of the world, from the front page of a tabloid that I was... I don't know." He shook his head.
"Well, it wasn't as if it was anything serious," said Quigley. "The woman's a high-class hooker, like Tommy says."
"Don't call her that," said Sherman, in a low, melancholy voice, without looking at Quigley.
"She's the only decent person in this whole mess," Killian said.
"She's so decent she's going to rat you out, if she ain't already done it."
"She was prepared to do the right thing," said Sherman. "I'm convinced of that, and I shoved her good instincts right back in her face."
"Get out of here. I don't believe I'm listening to this.
She didn't call me up and ask me to meet her in that apartment in order to do me in. I went there wired, to do her in. What did she have to gain by seeing me? Nothing. Her lawyers probably told her to have nothing to do with me." Killian nodded.
"That's true."
But that isn't the way Maria's mind works. She isn't cautious. She isn't going to turn legalistic just because she's in a tight corner. I once told you her medium was men, and that's the truth, just the way a dolphin's medium is the sea.
Would you settle for a shark? Said Killian.
No.
Okay, have it your way. She's a mermaid.
You can call her what you want, but I'm convinced that whatever she was going to do in this case concerning me, a man she'd been involved with, she wasn't going to do it behind a screen of lawyers, and she wasn't going to come wired for evidence. Whatever was going to happen, she wanted to see me, be next to me, have a real talk with me, an honest talk, not some game with words, and go to bed with me. You may think I'm crazy, but that's exactly what she wanted to do. Killian just raised his eyebrows. I also believe she didn't go to Italy to duck out of this case. I think she went for exactly the reason she said, to get away from her husband and from me, and I don't blame her. And to go have fun with a good-looking boy. You can call that being a hooker if you want, but she's the only one in this whole thing who's walked in a straight line.
That's a neat trick, walking on your back, said Killian.
What's C.S. Lewis's emergency nightline number? We got a whole new concept of morality going here.
Sherman drove his fist into his hand.
I can't believe what I've done. If I had only played it straight with her, me, with my pretensions of respectability and propriety, and now look at this.
He picked up the city light, more than ready to drown himself in his public shame.
Love nest, tryst pad, a picture of the very bed where the millionairess Maria entertained McCoy. This is what my wife picks up, she and a couple of million other people, and my daughter. My little girl's almost 7. Her little friends will be perfectly capable of filling her in on what all this means, and ready and eager, you can be sure of that. Imagine! That son of a bitch Winter, he's so slimy he takes the press in to take a picture of the bed,
Quigley said. They're wild men, Mr. McCoy. These landlords in the rent-controlled buildings, they're maniacs. They get one thing in their minds from morning to night, and that's getting tenants out. Ain't no Sicilian hates anybody worse than a rent-controlled landlord hates his tenants. They think the tenants are stealing their life's blood. They go crazy. This guy sees Maria Ruskin's picture in the paper, and she's got a 20-room apartment on Fifth Avenue, and he flips out and goes running to the newspaper.
Sherman opened the newspaper to page 3, where the full story began. There was a picture of the front of the brownstone, another picture of Maria, looking young and sexy, a picture of Judy looking old and haggard, another picture of himself and his aristocratic chin, and a big grin.
"That'll do it," he said to himself, but loud enough for Killian and Quigley to hear,
sinking, sinking, diving down into his shame. Reading aloud, Winter said he had information that Mrs. Ruskin was paying $750 a month under the table to the actual leaseholder Germaine Bull, who then paid the $331 controlled rent.
That's true, said Sherman.
But I wonder how he knew it. Maria didn't tell him, and I'm sure Germaine didn't tell him. Maria mentioned it to me once, but I never mentioned it to a soul.
Where? Asked Quigley.
Where what?
Where were you when she told you about it?
I was... It was the last time I was in the apartment. It was the day the first story came out in the city light. It was the day that big lunatic, that Hasidic monster, came barging in.
Hey, said Quigley. A smile spread over his face. You see it, Tommy?
No, said Killian.
Well, I do, said Quigley. I could be wrong, but I think I see it.
See what?
That sneaky son of a bitch, said Quigley.
What are you talking about?
I'll tell you later, said Quigley, still grinning. Right now, I'm going over there.
He left the room and went walking down the corridor at a good clip.
What's he doing? Asked Sherman.
I'm not sure, said Killian.
Where's he going?
I don't know. I let him do what he wants. Quigley is a force of nature.
Killian's telephone rang, and the receptionist's voice came over the intercom.
It's Mr. Fitzgibbon on 3-0.
I'll take it, said Killian, and he picked up the telephone. Yeah, Bernie?
Killian listened, with his eyes looking down, but every now and then they turned up and picked out Sherman. He took some notes. Sherman could feel his heart starting to bang away.
On what theory? Said Killian. He listened a bit more. That's bullshit, and you know it.
Yeah, well, I'm...
What? Whose part's it going into?
Uh-huh.
After a while, he said,
Yeah, he'll be there.
He looked up at Sherman when he said that.
Okay, thanks, Bernie.
He hung up and said to Sherman,
Well,
the grand jury has returned an indictment against you. She ratted you out.
He told you that?
No, he can't talk about what goes on inside the grand jury, but he put it there between the lines.
What does this mean? What happens now?
The first thing that happens is tomorrow morning the DA petitions the court to set higher bail.
Higher bail? How can they do that?
The theory is that now that you've been indicted, you'll have an increased motivation to flee the jurisdiction of the court.
But that's absurd.
Of course it is. But that's what they're doing, and you gotta be there for it.
A terrible realization was beginning to come over Sherman. How much will they ask for?
Bernie don't know, but it'll be a lot. $500,000, $250,000 anyway, some bullshit figure. It's just Weiss playing for the headlines, playing for the black vote.
But can they actually put it that high?
It all depends on the judge. The hearing's before Kavitsky, who's also the supervising judge of the grand jury. He's got a pair of stones. With him, at least you got a fighting chance.
But if they do it, how long do I have to raise the money?
How long?
As soon as you post the bond, you're out.
I'm out? Terrible realization.
What do you mean, out?
Out of custody.
But why would I be in custody?
Well, as soon as a new bail is set, you're in custody until you post bond. Unless you post it immediately.
Wait a minute, Tommy. You don't mean that if they raise my bail tomorrow morning, they put me in custody immediately right there as soon as the bail is set?
Well, yeah. But don't jump to conclusions.
You mean they take me right there in the courtroom?
Yeah, if, but don't.
Take me and put me where?
Well, the Bronx House of Detention, probably, but the point is...
Sherman began shaking his head. He felt as if the lining of his skull were inflamed.
I can't do that, Tommy.
Don't immediately assume the worst. There's things we can do.
Still shaking his head.
There's no way I can get $500,000 this afternoon and put it in a bag.
I'm not talking about anything like that, for Christ's sake. It's a bail hearing. The judge has to hear the arguments. We got a good argument.
Oh, sure, said Sherman. You said yourself the thing's a political football.
He hung his head and shook it some more.
Jesus Christ, Tommy. I can't do it.
Ray Andreuti was wailing down his pepperoni and his coffee swill, and Jimmy Cowie held half a roast beef hero up in the air like a baton while he talked to somebody on the telephone about some piece of shit he'd been assigned to. Kramer wasn't hungry. He kept reading the story in the City Light. He was fascinated. Rent-controlled love nest, $331 a month. The revelation didn't really affect the case much one way or the other. Maria Ruskin wouldn't come off as quite the sympathetic little lovely who had wowed them in the grand jury room. But she'd make a good witness all the same. And when she did her Shulman duet with Roland Auburn, he'd have Sherman McCoy cocked and locked. Rent-controlled love nest, $331 a month. Did he dare call Mr. Heilig Winter?
Why not?
He should interview him in any case, see if he can amplify the relationship of Maria Ruskin and Sherman McCoy as it pertains to rent-controlled love nest, $331 a month. Sherman walked out of the living room and into the entry gallery and listened to the sound of his shoes on the solemn green marble. Then he turned and listened to himself walking across the marble to the library. In the library, there was still one lamp by a chair that he hadn't turned on, so he turned it on. The entire apartment, both floors, was blazing with light and throbbing with stillness. His heart was working away at a good clip. In custody. Tomorrow, they would put him back in there.
He wanted to cry out, but there was no one in this vast apartment to cry out to, nor anyone outside it. He thought of a knife. In the abstract, it was so steely efficient, a long kitchen knife. But then he tried to enact it in his mind. Where would you thrust it in? Could he stand it? What if he made a bloody mess of it? Throw himself out a window? How long before he hit the pavement from this height? Seconds. Interminable seconds. In which he would think of what? Of what it would do to Campbell. Of how he was taking the coward's way out. Was he even serious about it? Or was this just superstitious speculation in which he presumed if he thought of the worst he could bear, the actual back in there? No, he couldn't bear it. He picked up the telephone and called the number in Southampton again. No answer. There had been no answer all evening, despite the fact that, according to his mother, Judy and Campbell, Bonita, Miss Lyons, and the dachshund had left the house on East 73rd Street for Southampton before noon. Had his mother seen the newspaper article? Yes. Had Judy seen it? Yes. His mother hadn't even been able to bring herself to comment on it. It was too sordid to discuss. Then how much worse it had been for Judy. She hadn't gone to Southampton at all. She had decided to disappear, taking Campbell with her to the Midwest, back to Wisconsin. A flash of memory. The bleak plains, punctuated only by silvery aluminum water towers in the shape of modernistic mushrooms and clumps of wispy trees. A sigh. Campbell would be better off there than in New York, living with the degraded memory of a father who in fact no longer existed, a father cut off from everything that defined a human being, except his name, which was now that of a villainous cartoon that newspapers, television, and slanderers of every sort were free to make sport of as they saw fit. Sinking, 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 he gave himself up to ignominy and self-pity. Until, on about the 12th ring, someone picked up the telephone. Hello? Judy? A pause. I thought it might be you, said Judy. I suppose you saw the story, Sherman said. Yes. Well, look, unless you want me to hang up right now, don't even talk about it, don't even begin. He hesitated. How is Campbell? She's doing all right. How much does she know? She understands that there's trouble. She knows something's up. I don't think she knows what. Fortunately, school is over, although it'll be bad enough out here. Let me explain. Don't. I don't want to listen to your explanations. I'm sorry, Sherman, but I don't feel like having my intelligence insulted, not any more than it already has been. All right. But I ought to at least tell you what's going to happen. I'm going back into custody tomorrow. Back into jail. Softly. Why? Why? It doesn't matter why. I cry out to you to hold me, but I no longer have the right. So he merely explained to her the problem of the increased bail.
I see,
she said. He waited a moment, but that was it. Judy, I just don't know if I can do it.
What do you mean?
It was horrible the first time, and I was only inside for a few hours in a temporary detention pen. This time it'll be in the Bronx House of Detention.
But only until you post bail.
But I don't know if I can even take a day of it, Judy. After all this publicity, it'll be full of people who have it in for me. I mean, it's bad enough even when they don't know who you are. You can't imagine what it's like. He stopped. I want to cry out to you. But he had lost the right. She picked up the agony in his voice.
I don't know what to say to you, Sherman. If I could be with you in some way, I would. But you keep cutting the ground out from under me. We've had this same conversation before. What do I have left to give you? I just feel so sorry for you, Sherman. I don't know what else to tell you.
Judy?
Yes?
Tell Campbell I love her very much. Tell her to think of her father as the person who was here before all this happened. Tell her that all this does something to you and that you can never be the same person again. Desperately, he wanted Judy to ask him what he meant. At even the most tentative invitation, he was ready to pour out everything he felt. But all she said was, "I'm sure she'll always love you no matter what." "Judy?"
"Yes?"
"Do you remember when we used to live in the village, the way I used to go off to work?"
"The way you used to go off to work?"
"When I first started working for Pearson Pierce, the way I used to give you the raised left fist when I left the apartment, the black power salute?"
"Yes, I remember."
"You remember why?"
"I guess so."
"It was supposed to say that, yes, I was going to work on Wall Street, but my heart and soul would never belong to it. I would use it and rebel and break with it. You remember all that?" Judy said nothing. "I know it didn't work out that way," he went on. "But I remember what a lovely feeling it was. Don't you?" Again silence. "Well, now I've broken with Wall Street, or Wall Street's broken with me. I know it's not the same thing, but in an odd way I feel liberated." He stopped, hoping to coax a comment. Finally, Judy said,
"Sherman?"
"Yes?"
"That's a memory, Sherman. But it's not alive."
Her voice broke.
"All our memories of that time have been terribly abused. I know you want me to tell you something else, but I've been betrayed, and I've been humiliated. I wish I could be something I was a long time ago and help you, but I can't."
Snuffling back tears. "It would help if you could forgive me. If you would give me one last chance."
"You asked me that once before, Sherman. All right, I forgive you. And I'll ask you again. What does that change?"
She was crying softly. He had no answer. And that was that. Afterward, he sat in the brilliant, blazing stillness of the library. He sank back into the swivel chair at his desk. He was aware of the pressure of the edge of the seat on the underside of his thighs. Oxblood Moroccan leather. $1,100 just to cover the back and the seat of this one chair. The library door was open. He looked out into the entry gallery. There on the marble floor, he could see the extravagantly curved legs of one of the Thomas Hope armchairs. Not a mahogany reproduction, but one of the rosewood originals. Rosewood! The childish joy with which Judy had discovered her rosewood originals. The telephone rang. She was calling back. He picked up the receiver at once. "Hello?"
"Hey, Sherman!"
His heart sank again. It was Killian. "I want you to come on back down here. Got something to show you." "You're still at your office?" "Quigley's here, too. We got something to show you." "What is it?"
"Just as soon not talk about it on the telephone. I want you to come on down here."
"All right. I'll leave right now." He wasn't sure he could have remained in the apartment another minute, in any case. At the old building on Reed Street, the night watchman, who appeared to be Cypriot or Armenian, was listening to a country music station on a huge portable radio. Sherman had to stop and write down his name and the time on a ledger. In a thick accent, the watchman kept joining in the chorus of the song. "My chin's up, my smile's on, my heart's feeling down." Which came out,
"My chin's up, my smile's on, my heart's feeling down."
Sherman took the elevator up, walked through the dingy stillness of the corridor, and came to the door with the incised plastic sign that read Dershkin, Bellavita, Fishbein, and Schlossel. For an instant, he thought of his father. The door was locked. He rapped on it, and after 5 or 10 seconds, Ed Quigley opened it.
"Hey, come on in," said Quigley.
His dour face was all lit up. Beaming is the word. All of a sudden, he was Sherman's warmest pal. Half a chuckle bubbled out of him as he led Sherman toward Killian's office. Killian was standing inside with the smile of the cat that ate the canary. On his desk was a large tape machine that was obviously from the higher and more sophisticated reaches of the audiovisual kingdom.
"Hey," said Killian. "Have a seat. Get a good grip on yourself. Wait till you hear this."
Sherman sat down beside the desk.
"What is it?"
"You tell me," said Killian. Quigley stood next to Killian, looking at the machine and fidgeting like a schoolboy on stage to receive a prize.
"I don't want you to get your hopes up too high over this thing," said Killian, "because there's a couple very serious problems with it, but you'll find it interesting."
He pushed something on the machine, and a stream of low static began. Then a man's voice.
"I knew it. I knew it at the time. We should have reported it immediately."
For the first second or so, he didn't recognize it. Then it sank in. My own voice. It continued,
I can't believe we're in this situation.
A woman's voice.
Well, it's too late now, Sherman.
Sherman.
That's spilt milk.
The entire scene, the fear, the tension, the very atmosphere of it, flooded through Sherman's nervous system. In her hideaway, the evening the first article about Henry Lamb appeared in the City Light. Honor student's mom, cops sit on hit and run. He could see the headline itself on top of the oak pedestal table. His voice.
Just tell what actually happened.
Her voice.
That'll sound wonderful. Two boys stopped us and tried to rob us, but you threw a tire at one of them, and I drove out of there like a hot rodder, but I didn't know I hit anybody.
Well, that's exactly what happened, Maria. And who's going to believe it?
Sherman looked at Killian. Killian had a tight little smile on his face. He raised his right hand as if to caution Sherman to keep listening and not speak yet. Quigley kept his eyes fixed on the magical machine. His lips were pursed to hold back the broad grin he felt he was due. Soon the giant arrived.
"You live here?"
His own voice.
"I said we don't have time for this."
He sounded terribly snooty and precious. All over again, he felt the humiliation of that moment, the dreadful feeling that he was about to be forced into a masculine duel, very likely physical, that he could not possibly win.
"You don't live here, and she don't live here. What are you doing here?"
The snooty fellow.
"That's not your concern. Now be a good fellow and leave."
"You don't belong here, okay? We got a real problem."
Then Maria's voice, the squabbling, a tremendous crack as the chair breaks and the giant hits the floor, his ignominious retreat, Maria's whoops of laughter. Finally, her voice saying,
"Jermaine pays only $331 a month, and I pay her $750. It's rent-controlled. They'd love to get her out of here."
Soon the voices stopped, and Sherman remembered, felt, the fitful session on the bed. When the tape had played out, Sherman said to Killian,
"My God, that's astounding. Where did that come from?"
Killian looked at Sherman but pointed his right index finger at Quigley. So Sherman looked at Quigley. It was the moment Quigley had been waiting for.
"As soon as you told me where she told you about her rent scam, I knew it. I just fucking knew it. Those lunatics. This Heilig Winter ain't the first one. The voice-activated tapes. So I went straight over there. This character has microphones hidden in the intercom boxes inside the apartments. The recorder's down in the cellar in a locked closet."
Sherman stared at the man's suddenly radiant face. "But why would he even bother?"
"To get the tenants out," said Quigley. "Half the people in these rent-controlled apartments ain't in there legally. Half of them are scamming, just like your friend there. But proving it in court is another thing. So this lunatic's taping every conversation in the joint with a voice-activated tape. Believe me, he ain't the first one, either."
"But isn't that illegal?"
"Illegal?" said Quigley with great joy. "It's so fucking illegal, it ain't even funny. It's so fucking illegal, if he walked in that door right now, I'd say, 'Hi, I took your fucking tape, what do you think of that?' And he'd say, 'I don't know what you're talking about,' and walk away like a nice boy. But I'm telling you, these maniacs are crazed."
"And you just took it? How did you even get in there?" Quigley shrugged with consummate smugness.
"That's no big deal."
Sherman looked at Killian.
Christ, then maybe, if that's on tape, then maybe... Right after the thing happened, Maria and I went back to her apartment and we talked the whole thing over. Everything that happened. If that's on tape, that would be fantastic.
It ain't there, said Quigley. I listened to miles of this stuff. It don't go back that far. He must erase it every now and then and record right over it, so we don't have to keep buying new tapes.
His spirits soaring, Sherman said to Killian, Well, maybe this is enough. Quigley said,
Incidentally, you ain't the only visitor she receives in that joint.
Killian broke in.
Yeah, well, that's of historical interest at this point. Now here's the thing, Sherman. I don't want you to get your hopes up too high over this. We got two serious problems. The first one is that she don't come right out and say she hit the kid and you didn't. What she says is indirect. Half the time it sounds like she might be going along with what you're saying. Nevertheless, it's a good weapon. It's certainly enough to create doubt in a jury. She certainly seems to be concurring with your theory that this was a robbery attempt, but we got another problem, and to be honest with you, I don't know what the hell we can do about it. There's no way I can get this tape into evidence.
You can't? Why not?
Like Ed says, this is a totally illegal tape. This crazy guy Winter could go to jail for doing this. There is absolutely no way that a surreptitious, illegal tape can be used as evidence in a court of law.
Well then, why did you wire me? That's a surreptitious tape. How could that be used?
It's surreptitious, but not illegal. You're entitled to record your own conversation, secretly or not. But if it's somebody else's conversation, it's illegal. If this lunatic landlord Winter was recording his own conversations, there'd be no problem.
Sherman stared at Killian with his mouth open, his just-hatched hopes already crushed.
But that's not right. Here's... vital evidence. They can't suppress vital evidence on a technicality.
I got news for you, bro. They can. They would. What we gotta do is think of some way to use this tape to get somebody to give us some legitimate testimony. Like if there's some way we can use this to make your friend Maria come clean. You got any bright ideas?
Sherman thought for a moment. Then he sighed and looked off past the two men. It was all too preposterous. I don't know how you'd even get her to listen to the goddamn thing. Killian looked at Quigley. Quigley shook his head. The three of them were quiet.
Wait a minute, said Sherman.
Let me see that tape.
See it? Said Killian.
Yes, give it to me.
Take it off the machine?
Yes. Sherman held out his hand. Quigley rewound it and took it off the machine very gingerly. As if it were a precious piece of hand-blown glass. He gave it to Sherman. Sherman held it in both hands and stared at it.
I'll be damned, he said, looking up at Killian. It's mine.
What do you mean it's yours?
This is my tape. I made it.
Killian looked at him quizzically as if searching out a joke.
What do you mean you made it?
I wired myself up that night because this article in the City Light had just come out, and I figured I might need some verification of what actually happened. What we just listened to, that's the tape I made that night. This is my tape.
Killian's mouth was open.
What are you saying?
I'm saying I made this tape. Who's going to say I didn't? This tape is in my possession, right? Here it is. I made this tape in order to have an accurate record of my own conversation. Tell me, counselor, would you say this tape is admissible in a court of law?
Killian looked at Quigley.
Jesus H. fucking Christ.
Then he looked at Sherman.
Let me get this straight, Mr. McCoy. You're telling me you wired yourself and made this tape of your conversation with Mrs. Ruskin?
Exactly. Is it admissible?
Killian looked at Quigley, smiled, then looked back.
It's entirely possible, Mr. McCoy, entirely possible. But you gotta tell me something. Just how did you make this tape? What kind of equipment did you use? How did you tape yourself? I think if you want the court to admit this evidence, you better be able to account for everything you did from A to Z.
Well, said Sherman, I'd like to hear Mr. Quigley here guess how I did it. He seems knowledgeable in this area. I'd like to hear him guess.
Quigley looked at Killian.
Go ahead, Ed.
said Killian. Take a guess.
Well, said Quigley, if it was me, I'd get me a Nagra 2600 voice-activated, and I'd...
He proceeded to outline in great detail just how he would use the fabled Nagra machine and wire himself and make sure he secured the highest quality recording of such a conversation. When he was